This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 310 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined by two great co-hosts. First, we have David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian from the What Just Flew By blog.
Hey, Max. Great to be here. Sorry that we're missing in action in the Pacific, but looking forward to a good show.
All right. Also co-hosting is the other Max, Max Trescott, not to be confusing. But Max, good to talk to you again.
I'll try not to be confusing. Hello, Max. It's Max here from the West Coast. And David, what do you mean? Lost over the Pacific? I'm sure we'll find out, though.
Well, that's true. What David is alluding to is that our guest this episode was to be Amelia Rose Earhart. And she, as I think all of our listeners know, recently circumnavigated the globe in a Pilatus PC-12 to recreate and, I guess, symbolically complete her namesake's famous flight. Well, as we speak, Amelia is still on the road trying to get home from Oshkosh, but she's encountering some travel issues and unfortunately won't be able to join us. This episode, we're going to discuss some current aviation topics, including Boeing announces an ab initio pilot program. Also, the airline industry sues the TSA over security fee hikes. David, we have a aircraft of the week that I guess is related to our unavailable guest.
Yeah, I busted my butt today to do a segment on the PC-12. She's lucky that it's one of my more favorite airplanes, so I'm good with doing it. So we're looking forward to talking about the Pilatus single engine wonder.
Hey, we're all lucky. We get to hear about the PC-12. Great plane.
Also coming up, Rob Mark was at Oshkosh this year, and he recorded some interviews. Rob talked with AOPA President Mark Baker. And then in this week's Australia Desk, Steve and Grant are in Sydney to shoot a video for Airbus as the A350XWB makes its first visit to Australia. They talk about Tiger Air safety-related incidents and Brumby aircraft, who have a new deal with China's AVIC. So we'll look forward to that. Peter Johnson's Across the Pond segment is off this week. We'll look for Peter next time around. Also coming up, we've got Rob's Aviation Minute and some listener feedback. We have more on the Transparent Airfares Act. In fact, we have some feedback from two listeners, one of whom has a response from his congressman on this topic. We have a, quote, scheduled charter airline to talk about. We received a couple of plane spotting questions from listeners, and we even have an airport breathing tax. So with that little teaser, why don't we get started right away with the news? Everyone ready?
Ready.
Ready.
In AvWeb, we have Boeing announces ab initio pilot program, except it doesn't work in the U.S. Boeing announced this program that is for pilots to be qualified to go right to the right seat of airliners in most countries, but not the U.S. We'll talk about that in a second. Really, there's two parts to this program. And Max T, you want to kind of lead us through those two parts that Boeing has created here?
Sure. The first part's going to be run by Jeppesen, which we all know as the longtime company that created instrument charts that have been used by pilots for more than 50 years. Of course, Boeing bought Jeppesen a few years ago. And they're going to go ahead and take pilots through that from basically from 0 hours up to somewhere between 200 and 250 hours through that program. And that, by the way, is run by David Wright, who used to be at AOPA a number of years ago. David was in the, ASI, the Aviation Safety Institute, and he's also out of this area here in California originally. The second phase is really a real plus, I think, for these overseas airlines. The cadets will get to go through a Boeing facility for 2 months of training in a full-motion jet simulator. And that's the part of the training that typically hasn't happened for a lot of the overseas airlines that have been doing pilot training here in the United States. So I think a lot of them will look at that as a real real bonus.
And that gives them a type rating, a Boeing type rating, doesn't it?
Yep, exactly. And of course, you said it doesn't work in the U.S. You could theoretically get all this training in the U.S., but what wouldn't work is you wouldn't be able to move to the right seat of a regional jet until you got another 1,250 hours, all the way up to 1,500 total. A lot of overseas airlines will put people in the right seat of a jet with just 250 hours. And that did happen to some extent here in the U.S., but no more now that we've got the new requirements for an ATP and 1,500 hours to fly jets in the U.S.
Now, I see in the article, or perhaps in the press release from Boeing, I don't recall which, but Boeing says that for U.S. graduates, that they'll look to hire them into the program as flight instructors. So that should help them build the hours that they need for the ATP license.
And a lot of flight schools have traditionally done that. They'll take graduates from the program and recycle a certain percentage of them back in as flight instructors to allow them to build time. And I think that's a pretty good deal for everyone. And I think that Boeing is pretty clever to build that into the program. So even though, the bad news is that when people come out of the program, they can't immediately go work for the airlines in the U.S. At least Boeing does have an option for some percentage of them that will get them to the airlines.
Now, this, of course, comes at a cost. There's a price for doing this, and the article says it's between $100,000 and $150,000 for this program, which sounds like a lot. It is a lot, but it does get you pretty much all the way through to where you can begin your professional flying career. So I think this is an interesting idea. I don't know if others have embarked on anything as sort of aggressive as this, but I think Boeing is looking at their own forecast for the number of airliners that we're looking at over the next 20 years and calculating the number of pilots, not to mention maintenance technicians, but at least looking at the pilots that have to be created, the jobs that need to be filled by pilots. And of course, those numbers are huge. And I think unless someone takes some action like this, then that mystical pilot shortage would, appear sooner or later.
Well, I think it's a good deal for both overseas airlines that might choose to run their pilots through this program, as well as for Boeing, but for different reasons. Right now here on the West Coast, we have many, many flight schools that each cater to an individual airline. Here in the San Francisco Bay Area, for many years, we've had a flight school that was doing all the flight training for Japan Airlines. And if you go over to just a couple cities over, another one that's been doing a lot of training for Korean Airlines. And the story goes on. If you go down to Phoenix, I think there are one or more European airlines that do their training down in that area as well. So for companies overseas that have had to set up their own training facilities here in the United States, they're probably going to look at this and go, this might be worth, just outsourcing and not having to create our own school. Plus, their own individual schools probably didn't have the kind of simulator training available that Boeing's going to have. So I think it's going to be a win-win where they'll look at the numbers and some of them will say, yes, it's going to cost more per pilot, but it's a better overall program and it saves a lot of management hassle. Now, for Boeing, if you look as a parallel, look, for example, at Cessna. How has Cessna over the years tried to get pilots into their airplane? Well, they've created Cessna pilot centers, and they've trained pilots first in Cessnas, thinking that someday they will then buy Cessnas, and that will help their market share. I think Boeing is very cleverly looking at if they can create a whole new generation of pilots that were trained by Boeing in Boeings. Long-term, that may influence their sales and give them a leg up against Airbus.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty perceptive comment, because you do have to ask yourself, you know, what's the motivation for Boeing to do this? And I mean, there can be several, but I think you might be right that the that this might ultimately translate into sales for them is probably the best case that that they would look for from a program like this.
And it's highly complementary to everything they're doing. And frankly, it provides a nice growth opportunity for Jeppesen. You know, Jeppesen has done a great job, you know, selling all the books and training materials that you need to get all your pilot licenses anyway. So this is a great growth opportunity for them to leverage, you know, all the intellectual property they already have and just, you know, go into the next phase, which is actually training the people themselves.
All right. Very good. Why don't we move on to our next story? This comes from Forbes. Airline industry takes gloves off, sues TSA over security fee hike. So recently, the TSA, the Transportation Security Administration, increased the fee, the security fee that is paid by airline passengers. Previously, the fee, and this came in obviously after 9/11, but the fee was $2.50 per flight, or what they call enplanement. But there was a $10 maximum cap. So if you took a nonstop flight from your point of origin to your destination, that was a $2.50 flight. If you had a stop in between, that would be $5 for that flight. And then similarly, $5 on the way back. But it had this $10 cap. But as of July 21st this year, 2014, they changed the way this fee is handled. So now there's a flat fee of $5.60 per one-way trip, or $11.20 for a round trip. And it doesn't matter how many enplanements, how many stops you have. That sounds like not much of a change in terms of effectively how much it costs you, except that a layover of more than 4 hours is considered another trip. Previously, you could actually have a layover of a day or even a couple of days, and it would still be considered part of the one trip. Now, if you stop for more than 4 hours, it's another $5.60. So this can add up depending on how your flight schedule works. So some of the trade groups are, well, they're not very pleased with this situation, are they?
Well, I wouldn't be. I mean, I used to fly through Chicago all the time, and what happens if you have an unintentional layover of over 4 hours? Does that mean they get to charge you the additional fee?
Sounds
you know, it. Well, then screw that.
You're not very enthusiastic about this either.
Well, this is supposed to fund the Transportation Safety Administration. They already get lots and lots of money, and what is it they do? I mean, why do they need more? And this is really a backhanded way to get more. I mean, if people disagree with me, that's fine. But it's a backhanded way to get more. It makes it look cheaper. However, I mean, most layovers aren't 1 or 2 hours. I mean, if you, I don't know. It's just, and like I said, I used to fly to O'Hare or wherever else I went in the universe, and I could always get to O'Hare, but I never seemed to get out of O'Hare on time, which is what we used to call the Vanderhoof curse, because my brother has the same issue. But yeah, I've had 4 hour layovers there, and I don't think it's fair that since the airlines are forcing me to stay there so I can get another flight, why should I have to pay the TSA? And add to that, there's a 90% chance that I will not have to go through another TSA checkpoint during that 4 hour layover.
So you may not be incurring any additional cost to them. Well, David, part of what you say is what has the Airlines for America, A4A, and also the International Air Transport Association, IATA, up in a bunch, and they've filed petition over this in federal court. The TSA responds and says, look, we're just doing what Congress wants, because that's what they do. We're just following the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2013, which they say doesn't include a limit on the number of one-way trips that can be charged in any one itinerary. But A4A and IATA say, no, that's not correct. And they produce a letter to the head of the DHS from the chairs of the congressional budget committees that say Congress did not intend to eliminate the round-trip cap on fees. But that's not all. The Budget Act, apparently, and I didn't know this before, it requires that receipts in excess of $250 million that go into the Aviation Security Capital Fund have to be deposited in the general fund of the Treasury. So that means money spills over from basically the TSA into the general fund. So A4A says, nah, this is not right. The feds are using these fees to pay down the federal deficit. And they're not happy with that. So, there's a number of different issues here, but it's in the court. We don't know how long those kinds of things take to resolve. I don't expect this to resolve quickly, unless there's some kind of a settlement between them all. And I'm not sure I see that happening.
All I got to say is it better be gone before I fly in October. Or there will be hell to pay.
Okay. Well, just don't protest too vigorously, David, or you'll find yourself going through some additional screening before you get onto your plane.
Okay.
And that's why I haven't said anything, because I don't want the TSA to target me.
That's right.
I'm kidding, of course.
David's painting a target on his back, I think. But well, we have another item from USA Today, regional airline buzz job.
Oh boy, this is really disgusting. You know, it really just irks me when airline pilots show reckless, wanton disregard for the rules, and that's pretty much what this fellow did. If you go back to, it's funny that it's all coming out now. I'm not sure why, but December 21st, 2012, a pilot who was flying from Philadelphia to Maryland decided...
Oh, it's always Philly. It's always got to be Philly, doesn't it? It's always got to be Philly.
You know, I lived there for a long time, and I love that place. So I think that's just coincidence. I really don't think that's...
I don't. I've been doing the show way too long. It's always Philly.
Is it? Okay. Well, there we go. Why don't I just say that the flight was out of Trenton then?
I'm good with that.
There you go. Close enough. But anyway, this fellow apparently had a habit of flying over his home as he would fly into Salisbury, Maryland. And he would usually do it at 1,500 feet, but this time he did it at 400 feet above the ground.
What was he flying?
Let's see. He was flying a twin-engine turboprop. I forget exactly what it was.
Oh, probably sounds like a Dash 8 to me.
I think you're right. I think it was a Dash 8. But there were flight attendants who were somewhat scared when they looked out the window and declared they would never fly with him again. There were people on the ground who panicked when they saw the airplane flying so low over the mall. Basically, he scared the living heck out of people. And the airline announced that was also his last day of flying for Piedmont. So here's the amusing part of the story. That happened on December 21st, 2012. Go forward 6 months in June of 2013, and the FAA issued an emergency order to revoke his license. So it's a good thing that they rushed right in to solve that problem.
Wow.
His ATP certificate was revoked, which is a big deal, because that means you then have to go through written exams and check rides and all sorts of expense and additional time. So he apparently now has his license back, but we don't know where he's working. If he is.
To me, that sounds like an appropriate penalty to lose your license for a stunt like that.
I can't imagine anybody defending him. I really can't.
You'd be hard-pressed to.
No, I mean, this was clearly a judgment issue, and that kind of judgment, you just don't want people flying airplanes that have, especially ones that have 25 passengers in the back. I mean, It's one thing if you're out flying by yourself and you exercise poor judgment, but the public should not be exposed to this.
Mm. I flew into Salisbury once on a King Air, actually. That was some years ago. That was a fun flight. But we didn't buzz anybody.
And I had dinner there one night after going parachute jumping in the eastern shore there. That was the one time I went parachute jumping, and that was interesting. I jumped out of the airplane and decided, you know what, I'm glad I did it, but I think I'd much rather just stay in the airplanes and fly them rather than jump out of them.
Very good. I'm with you. And now here's Pete Combs from the National Business Aviation Association to tell us what to expect in the next NBAA Flight Plan podcast.
Hi, I'm Pete Combs, and if your business is flying, then you'll want to check out NBAA's Flight Plan. Whether you're flight crew, cabin crew, line crew, or maintenance, NBAA's Flight Plan is 5 minutes well spent on topics that range from safety to education to procedures both new and old. You'll find us on Apple's iTunes website or at the home of business aviation, nbaa.org.
Thanks, Pete. So to find the Flight Plan podcast at nbaa.org, you sort of have to navigate through a couple of levels to find it. So if you're having difficulty doing that, we've got a solution for you. If you visit airplanegeeks.com/flightplan, it'll take you right to that site. So that's a little shortcut you can use. All right, now it's time for the airplane of the week. And so we have David Vanderhoof, our Airplane Geeks historian. David, take it away.
Thanks, Max. Well, in honor of our missing guest, tonight's airplane is the Pilatus PC-12. Pilatus Aircraft has been around a long time. The Swiss company is located in the canton of Nidwalden. Being born in a wartime factory, it was supposed to be built in Mount Pilatus. A side note is, the Pilatus factory was the location in Goldfinger where James crashed his Aston Martin. That big factory up against the mountain.
That's the Pilatus factory?
That's the Pilatus factory.
Oh, wow. How did you know that, David?
Well, I know these things because I do research.
Okay.
Pilatus' biggest success was the PC-6 Porter, or Turbo Porter. The PC-6 has been in continuous production since 1959, but that's for another history segment. In 1987, work was begun on the PC-12. A full-size fuselage was displayed at NBAA in Atlanta in 1989. Rollout occurred on May 1st, 1991, with the first flight 30 days later. Tests concluded that there needed to be a redesign of the wings. To reach performance metrics, the wingspan was increased and winglets were added. The PC-12 is a single-pilot certified aircraft. The power plant is the Pratt Whitney Canada PT-6A-67B.
Yay!
The PT-6 generates 1,200 shaft horsepower. The PT-6 drives a four-blade Hartzell aluminum prop. PC-12 has a cruise speed of 312 miles per hour. Configured for 9 passengers, it has a range of 1,513 nautical miles. The PC-12 is not a small aircraft with a length of 47 feet 3 inches and a wingspan of 53 feet 3 inches. The 330 cubic foot cabin offers diverse options. A standard airliner version with 9 passengers, a 4-seat freight and combo version, lastly a bizjet interior with 6 seats. For the corporate transport, a bench seat can replace seats 5 and 6, making it a 7-place interior. Pilatus also has considered a pure freighter, but has not put one in production. In 1994, the Royal Flying Doctor Service in Australia was a launch customer for the PC-12 and eventually purchased 31 of the aircraft. The RFDS configured the PC-12 interior with 2 rearward-facing seats and 2 stretcher patients. One stretcher can be reconfigured to add 2 more seats. Plain Sense is a fractional ownership program that has 30 PC-12s, and they are headquartered at Peace International Airport in New Hampshire. Ah, the good old days when F-111s actually flew out of that base. Besides the current 30, they have 10 more on order from Pilatus. All of them have the 6-seat executive interior as their standard layout. In 2008, Pilatus created the PC-12NG, standing for Next Generation. The NG featured an all-glass cockpit. The Honeywell Primus Apex Avionics features 2 primary flight displays and 2 multifunction displays. The engine was upgraded to the PT-6A-67P, increasing the takeoff weight to 10,450 pounds. The winglets were modified to provide better performance. You can also tell the NG by the right wing having a weather radar on the wingtip. The NG has a 53-inch square cargo door. The door can also have a multi-purpose utility drop door built in it so that can be opened in flight. It could be used for search and rescue operations or power drops. The range and unimproved short field capabilities make the PC-12 a unique operator. Pilatus has marketed the PC-12 to military and paramilitary organizations. The Spectre, as the PC-12M is called, includes sensors and a sensor station. The sensors can be IR, low-light television. A sensor turret is located at the rear of the aircraft and can be raised and lowered during operations. The PC-12 has been purchased by the U.S. SOCOM, or Special Operations Command. They are flown by the 319th and 34th Special Operations Squadrons. There are current 21 aircraft in the fleet. Many are still in civilian colors. They are part of the NSAV, or Non-Standard Aircraft Fleet. And this is to quote SOCOM, the non-standard aircraft fleet is a general program term and encompasses several light and medium aircraft performing utility missions for SOCOM. Overall, the NSF mobility fleet untethers special operations forces from robust infrastructures, extended timelines, and allows freedom of movement. Bottom line is, they use these aircraft to fly people doing things that we don't really want to know about, and they don't want to get caught. The U-28, as they are called, have advanced communications and additional survivability equipment over the standard PC-12M. The United States Air Force lost a U-28A, callsign Ratchet 33, in Djibouti, West Africa. The crew on final had spatial disorientation and had a controlled flight into terrain, killing all four crew. The U.S. Air Force has proposed eliminating the U-28A in the 2015-2016 fiscal year and replacing them with MC-12 Liberties. To celebrate the 20th anniversary this year, Pilatus has offered new features for the aircraft. Six new interiors from BMW Designworks USA. New leathers, hardwoods, and cabinetries are fine accents to enhance your biz prop. Yes, I just coined that. To make Ms. Mary Kirby happy, a new Wi-Fi entertainment system with a moving map system has been built in for passengers. The cockpit is now iPad flight bag ready and has four apps to assist pilots in maintenance. The hydraulic landing gear is replaced with an all-electrical system, all at the reasonable price tag of $4.64 million. Currently, the 20-year production run, Pilatus has produced 1,300 PC-12s and is a consistent order stream through 2020. And with that note, this is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Hey, David, I actually met one of the pilots from SOCOM that fly those airplanes.
Did he like flying it? I get the impression everybody who's flown this aircraft likes it.
Oh, my God. You've never met a more enthusiastic Air Force pilot. That guy was in his early 20s, was a captain already, and he basically said that you can't believe the kinds of things we do in this airplane. So apparently they got a lot of performance out of it, and we're having a lot of fun flying it all over the world.
And they're cheap, too, in the scheme of the universe.
Exactly.
We purchased them for Operation Enduring Freedom and an Operation Iraqi Freedom. And they have half the carrying ability of a C-130, can get into much shorter runways, and you can make them look inconspicuous because most of the fleet are still in civilian colors. The only way you can tell is what looks like a November number is actually an 05 or 07 serial number. So it's a pretty cool airplane, and I've had family that had worked at Pilatus. So they used to, at Pilatus, my cousin's wife, who worked there for quite a few years, one of the joys was everybody got to go fly at least once a year in a PC-6.
That's good. Well, one of the things this guy really liked about it was the very short deployments, you know, so they weren't stuck in some remote part of the world for a year. You know, they'd be there for 6 weeks and then be home and then somewhere else. And I think he enjoyed kind of bouncing around the world like that.
Maxie, have you ever had the opportunity to fly a Pilatus?
You know, I have actually turned down the opportunity to fly one only because it wasn't particularly convenient. But yeah, they're fantastic airplanes.
All right, good. Very good. Thank you, David.
Here's Rob Mark interviewing Mark Baker, our new AOPA president at Oshkosh. Take it away, Rob.
Hi, it's Rob Mark. We're at Air Venture 2014. And we have a really special guest today. It's Mark Baker, who is the new president of the Aircraft Owner and Pilots Association, a group that I've been a member of for, well, not 75 years, but certainly a long time. And we're going to talk a little bit about where AOPA is headed in its 76th year. But, Mark, welcome to the Airplane Geeks.
Thank you. It's great to be here and great to be at Oshkosh on a sunny bluebird day.
It certainly is. And, of course, we're trying to fight the guys hanging these airplanes on the props out here. But so, you know, you mentioned that you came from Minnesota. Now, how did the AOPA guys find you? I mean, what were you doing before you became president?
I've been a retailer most of my life. I grew up in the Twin Cities, worked for a little lumber company called Knox Lumber Company, and from there progressed through the hardware home improvement groups to ultimately became the president of Midwest Division of Home Depot, then ultimately became chief operating and chief merchant for Home Depot back in the 2000s. And then I did a little stint with Scotts Miracle-Gro, did a stint with Gander Mountain as a CEO, then most recently did a spin out and sell a hardware store chain to us to Lowe's. And I was sitting at my desk one day and they called it, hey, how'd you like to recruiter? How'd you like to run a nonprofit? I said, are you kidding? It's hard enough. Then they said it was AOP. I said, I'm very interested.
So tell us about how you got started in flying, because you've obviously been flying for more than a couple of years.
Yeah, I started out in high school, I took ground school, and then I went to the University of Minnesota, and they offered ground school with 5 credits, so I took it again. Started taking my flying lessons in 1977 back then, but I'd, you know, grown up with my father and grandfather, who had very big interest in aviation, couldn't afford to fly. We'd always go out to the airport and the penny a pound rides and do that when I was a little kid.
Been here at AOPA a year in September. What do you think so far? I mean, what other than it's a really fun job and you get to come here for free, I mean, but what have you thought about AOPA so much being on the inside now as opposed to being on the outside like the rest of us?
Well, it's a great organization, and I've been a member of it, you know, on my own since the 70s as well. My instructor wouldn't sign me off for my take my license unless I signed up for AOPA in the 70s. So I've been a member, and I have a great deal of respect for the organization and the people that work hard. The foundation of AOPA started in 1939 with, you know, 4 or 5 guys sitting around a table in Wings Field just outside of Philadelphia, and with 4 fundamental things. And I've learned those things still exist. You know, protecting the freedom to fly, make sure that we can do the best we can on the cost of flying, safety, making sure that we're trying to do this as safely as possible, and add fun to aviation. Recognize it's a big smile. Aviation is supposed to be fun. And I think in some cases the organization has been kind of fatigued on a couple of issues, and I'm trying to re-inject, and I think we have been injecting through our regional fly-ins, a lot of fun factor back to AOPA, and seen a lot more members than we ever have in the past. So it's pretty exciting, and I'm really excited about the organization and get it what it can do to rejuvenate aviation.
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned these regional fly-ins, because we had one down at Indianapolis at the end of May, and that was the first one that some of us in Chicago could get to. But whose idea was that to sort of regionalize?
Well, I'll take a little bit of the credit, but the staff had really been thinking about this. The summit had run its course, or expo, and when I got here, we had to make the decision in September right away whether we're going to renew another summit location. It became clear to me that it was worth the risk. We announced it last year at the summit expo that we were going to move on to a new kind of venue. We didn't really know what it was going to look like at that time. We had hoped that we would see early on maybe 50 to 100 airplanes and maybe 500 to 700 people. You know, basically a large town hall, but, you know, have some fun, do some seminars, hopefully educate some things about aviation. Turned out the first one in San Marcos, Texas had, 400 or 500 airplanes. It was an IFR day and over 2,500 people. And same thing in Mount Comfort was the same kind of thing, 500 or 600 airplanes, 2,000 people. Plymouth, 500 or 600 airplanes, 2,000 people. So there's been really, these are people that are members and part of the aviation community, very active group. So the engagement level has just been terrific.
Keeping them involved is an important aspect. Bringing new people in is also, but we have to engage new pilots differently than we did, say, back in the old days when I joined it, I think. But so what's kind of on the horizon maybe for you in terms of engagement other than these regional?
Well, as part of the regional, we will be at almost 50 of these this year, what we call a Rusty Pilots, Lapsed Pilots program, where we send out an invitation because we know the names of almost and addresses of about 500,000 people, 500,000 people. They had a rating one time and a medical one time and are under age 75. That are the best way to grow the pilot population, to invite them back. It's part of inviting them back out to the community. It's getting them briefed on what's occurred since the last time they flew. Most of the information we're seeing, they've been gone on average 7 or 8 years. When they come back in and get this kind of training, their ground school for their BFR, if you will, looks like about 3/4 of them are signing up for flying lessons the next day. It's very good. I mean, we've seen over 1,000 rusty pilots so far this year.
And okay, wait. How rusty are they?
About 7 or 8 years out of date, so really rusty. Everybody that's been a pilot still considers themselves a pilot, as they should. So you just got to get them back out to the airport. And that little invitation says, free, show up, and we're going to teach you about everything that's occurred since the last time you fly.
really gets them back. We've talked about bringing rusty guys in. What about the big thing that everyone worries about, new pilots? How are we going to do that? Because they told me that, well, Matt told me that you have the absolute answer for that question.
Well, I don't know that there's a single silver bullet, but I do think we've got a pretty good idea how we're going to approach it this year. If you saw the little 152 out here, the little 152 is what we call You Can Fly. And it'll be an initiative not to kind of actualize how you can imagine you can fly. And that's kind of the J3 of our generation, if you will. And it needs to be updated, and it's been updated and cleaned up, and fresh motor, new wiring. But to point out, you can fly this for very little, because there's two or three things that really stop people from flying or don't make them feel comfortable about going out to the airport. It's still well over half the people say they'd like to fly someday. And the economics of being an airline pilot today is going to be better. It's going to get better and better and better, I think. So from a career point of view, I think you're going to start to see some of that. But there's also the fact that last year we graduated 22,000 pilots. Average age was 45. These are people that are coming back to it or coming back out to the airport for the first time. We've done a lot of things, in my opinion, to kind of push that away. The airports now say no trespassing, got fences all around them. And what kind of welcoming environment is that? Can I really go there and find out, using our website and others, to go, how do I make that access? Really important to try and get people back out there. Then it has to get into, you know, really starting to share what works well for these FBOs and these flight schools, sharing these best practices. And in our flight training magazine, always constantly talking about the customer experience. And you're starting to see some really good flight schools out there today, and trying to show how that can be really economic to run a really good flight school. It's good for the customer. We've got flight schools today that are getting 80% graduation rates, which never used to be, as you know.
Yeah.
And then the other part of it is cost. And that's why we wanted to introduce this 152 Reimagined. You know, at 5 gallons an hour, you can fly pretty cheap, pretty inexpensively. Put in a group, put in a club. And I think the club is the next big evolutionary turn in aviation. It's a way to lower the cost. It's a way to have great access and bring community out to the airport.
In fact, our flying club, Leading Edge Flying Club down at Palwaukee, has Benny Wilson's written about it a number of times, and it's been very, very successful because of that community, because we'll get people of a variety of different experience levels coming in, and they ask what they think of the dumb questions. We go, nah, that's no big, you know, oh yeah, I went through that, and it's a way to share that knowledge. But now, the reimagined airplane, in fact, Matt Detch and I were talking about that at Air and Space a couple of weeks ago when we were out there. I guess there's a plan to somehow sort of start a business or something, maybe with people that are going to be taking old airframes and making them new again, or I don't know if you can talk about that.
Well, what we do here right now is Aviat builds the Husky, Pitts, Christian Eagle, has been the factory that we've used to create the first three of these things. And they are taking orders today to produce them for clubs or individuals or partnerships right now across the airport. And they've offered, I think it's 10 of them, 150 starting at 89 and 152 is at 99,000, which we can finance 70% of that through AOPA today. So we got the financing and the insurance in place. Stu Horn, the leader of Aviat, is very excited about taking this on. And they are, by the way, a kind of quick story. That's the oldest, longest in production aircraft factory in the world. They've been continuously in production since 1940 in the same place in Afton, Wyoming. So they know what they're doing.
That is an issue that we've seen, is that people want to learn to fly and they go someplace and they look at this kind of ratty old beat up airplane. And I tried to take a student out once on an airplane and the guy put duct tape. I said, you know what? I'm not flying an airplane with duct tape. And I've got a lot of hours in the right seat of a 152. So that brings home an interesting point. But that look is really, the look and the feel is really important, isn't it?
It is. I mean, you know, people like to drive newer cars. They like to feel like it's going to be safe. If it smells better, it is probably better. You know, airplanes been there since 66 to 84, but those things were built. There were built over 25,000 of those things. There's still 13,000 on the registry. And it's a known product. It's a safe airplane. It's got enough power to haul two people around. The other thing I need to think about when I think about aviation, the fun factor, it's an airplane that you push out of the hangar by yourself and go for a 20-minute ride just to have fun for 5 gallons an hour. So that's what I'm saying is a part of...
One last question. Why should somebody join AOPA?
Well, I say, and the reason I joined AOPA is I believe in the mission. The mission is really about protecting the freedom to fly. We're stronger together. It's an important part of the association. When I go to Congress or I go up to the FAA and say, hey, you know, we've got 350,000 members here. We stand for general aviation. We're the largest aviation group in the world. And people look to us as a group to make sure that we can protect the freedom to fly, we can bring the safety messages back out to the public, and keep people current on the changes in regulation in airspace. You know, there's a couple other good things happening out there with AOP and why, you know, this Customs and Border Protection got a little out of control for a while there. Yeah, but because of the strength of this organization, I was able to get in, go all the way to the top. Kurlikowski as a commissioner, Jay Johnson as a secretary, have meetings with these guys and say, this is unacceptable. And frankly, they stopped it. We haven't gotten another report since. We said, you don't want to lose the public support here, and you will lose the public support if you keep doing these things. So it's the strength of that organization. You know, the replacement for AVGAS is coming along the way. The third-class medical reform is likely to happen, so we'll get more pilots back in the space. It's all because of the team at AOPA pushing those agendas.
Wow. Mark Baker, AOPA president, thank you so much, and thank you for joining us on the Airplane Geeks today from Oshkosh and beautiful Air Venture 2014.
Thank you.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, August 4th, 2014.
Well, good day, folks, and welcome to the Australia Desk for episode 310. And, Grant, is there an airport around here somewhere?
I think there may be, mate. I think there may be. I'm certainly standing here with my fingers in the airport fence entwined.
We certainly are. In fact, we're standing here at Kingsford Smith Airport, Sydney International Airport. What are we doing in Sydney, Grant? That's a long way from home.
Yeah. We thought we'd come up here and check out a few planes. And right now we're standing nice and close to a few wonderful King Airs from the... from the Air Ambulance Group.
But it's funny when you recognise a registration, actually, Graham. We're looking at the Air Ambulance here, VH November Alpha Juliet, and I'm thinking, I know that registration, because, you know, Grant, I did my first solo in November Alpha Juliet, but it was rather smaller back then.
Yeah.
Actually, it was 152, so yeah, no, it's been on steroids.
That's
turned
not
into a King Air.
Yeah, that's not a 152 that I've ever flown, mate.
Well, anyway, speaking of flying, I flew up here on Jetstar, which you're horrified about, but
you flew
up here on Virgin, but let's talk about my favourite airline. Said no one ever. Tiger Airways, what have they been up to?
Oh, no, it's Tiger Air, mate. Tiger Air. Time to spare, go Tiger Air.
Good Lord.
And they've been having some safety issues.
Yes, it looks like there's some issues going on between ground crew, the people that are loading up the aircraft, and their pilots. Things are not happy there. In fact, a load sheet came down for a flight recently with some very bad fuel figures in it. In fact, about 14 and a half tonnes lower than it should have been for a flight from Sydney to Perth is the allegation that we see in this article here in theage.com.au. Now, Grant, interestingly, it says here a bit further down that obviously the pilots worked out that all was not well and loaded up with fuel, but at the end of the flight they got to Perth, the pilots were still stood down for an investigation. So what's going on there?
Basically what happened there was that the dispatcher put together a flight plan with fuel based on zero passenger weight. So they had pretty much an empty aircraft and did the fuel burn for that, as opposed to a pretty full aircraft that was madly trying to get away from Sydney before the curfew kicked in. So the pilots realised this, factored in on the back of the envelope their own calculations, and went to say, let's go with this amount instead. Apparently when they landed, it was okay, they still had fuel left, but it wasn't what it should have been based on standards and so on. The fun part was that the dispatcher said that they hadn't really been given a lot of background training in how to use all the systems and and all the tools that they're supposed to use for preparing a flight path. They were a bit of a novice one, and they were basically showing how it works a couple of times and then told get out there and do it.
So I believe Tiger Airways uses a business model similar to that I've seen over in Europe with companies like EasyJet, where they don't use their own staff to do a lot of this stuff. They use third-party contractors, I think.
Well, you know, I've seen all the adverts. Tiger are definitely recruiting. And what I suspect is that this is a case of growth without the required training, a little bit too much cowboy. You know, get somebody up and running, get them into the place. But unfortunately, they weren't trained properly by the sounds of it, if what is being said by this dispatcher is correct. But you also mentioned some altercations between pilots and ground crew. Apparently there's been some harsh words and near fisticuffs between pilots and ramp workers as well.
Sounds like the same case as in the railways between drivers and anyone who's not a driver, actually.
Yeah, well, there is always that.
Yeah, in fact, the chief pilot is quoted in this article as advising his pilots to be very vigilant when dealing with ground crew and making sure that all these calculations and other ones similar to them are interesting. So perhaps not happy times still over there at Tiger Air. Kasser and the ATSB have been looking into this. It would appear at the bottom of this article it says here that whilst they did carry enough to satisfy Kasser, they didn't carry enough to satisfy their own company requirements in terms of correct. Reserve fuel when they landed at berth.
There's also been the case of a tug that the push bar disconnected from the nose wheel and impacted onto one of the engine cowlings. So that caused a little bit of fun as well. But, you know, poor old Tiger, a bit too much rabbit expansion, perhaps without the thought and effort required to make sure everyone's up to speed.
Well, expansion is not always a bad thing, Grant. And in fact, when we talk about aviation, we don't often cover general aviation here in this. Although, Grant, we've just eaten enough McDonald's, we could expand ourselves right out of our airline seat on the way home.
Don't go there.
Yeah, let's not go there.
Oh, please.
Let's talk about a local manufacturer here in New South Wales called Brumby Aircraft. They make light sport aircraft, and they've just signed a 40-year deal to manufacture their aircraft, the Brumby light sport aircraft, the Brumby low wing, in fact, over there in China, which is a fantastic deal. And for a small company based in the rural town of Cowra, which is several hundred kilometres away from here in Sydney, Paul Goward, the boss of the family-run company there, has done an outstanding job to bring this off. And looks like, in fact, they'll be bringing back an old aircraft type from the Victor Aircraft Company from many years ago. They've got the plans for the Victor Air Cruiser.
Yeah, that's right. That was the four-seat version of the Air Tourer. So looking forward to seeing what they can do with that. It's interesting because you've got Gips Aero down in Victoria, and they've turned around and worked with Mahindra. They're pretty much all but named Mahindra now. And they've bought the rights to build the Nomad and re-engineer that. So it'll be interesting to see how that one comes along after they stabilise the GA10. Now here we've got Brumby doing a deal with China, and sounds really good. One only hopes that it doesn't follow the path that some Chinese deals have done, which after a few years, the Chinese say, thank you, that's it, and then they start doing it all themselves.
Yeah, now I spoke to Brumby Aircraft this morning on the phone, and we're hoping to line them up for an interview soon, because this really is great news, and I did ask them that regarding the future of their factory in Cowra there. At the moment, they can only produce, I believe, five or six aircraft at a time, but apparently they're going to retain that factory. And in fact, it's going to be very heavily involved in the research and development for the Victor Air Cruiser. And at the moment, as you may or may not know, GA, private flying in China, is not on, but they're looking to change that. And Brumby getting in there now, looking at big companies like Cirrus, for example, and Continental that are now basically Chinese-owned and built. Brumby getting in there, that's a fantastic thing. Oh, yeah. So well done, guys.
And I've seen some of the photos and heard the stories of light sport aircraft being built in China. And the factory conditions are just fantastic. Absolutely incredible layouts, very attention to detail, schmick and clean. So absolutely brilliant stuff. And, yeah, good on them. I'm really looking forward to seeing how this develops.
Okay, now we're not just up in Sydney to stand here by the fence and record this report. We're actually up here at the request of Airbus. We're going to be doing a little bit of work for Airbus tomorrow. The A350XWB is coming out here to Sydney. It's transiting across from Johannesburg as we speak. It's going to spend a bit of time here in Sydney doing a media event tomorrow. Then it's going to Auckland. Then it's going to Perth. So it's crisscrossing all over this part of the world. Yep. And really looking forward to that. Some of the photos I've seen of that Airbus A350, very sleek-looking machine. I think it looks a bit better than the Dreamliner, actually, from its rival competitor.
Yeah, it doesn't have those upswept wings, so we'll see what happens with that. But, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it. Of course, it's really great that another airside servicing truck went past. But it's... Of course, it's really great that Airbus have asked us to come out here and shoot the video, and really looking forward to that. Of course, right now at the moment where the A350 is going to be tomorrow, there's a Boeing BBJ from the RAF parked over there. I think it's A36001, number one.
Oh, I'm very impressed, mate.
Well, you know...
What a serial number geek I am. Yeah,
exactly, exactly. So, we've got the BBJ, we've got some corporate jets, we've got a few King Airs. I think that's pinging my neurophycosis enough for now, and maybe we should look at heading back and getting some rest before an ODARC 30 ballooning type
start in
you
the
You can do what you like, mate. I'm standing here right at this fence all night. There's lots of aircraft here.
Yeah, I know,
anyway,
I know.
All right.
There's lots of buses and there's lots of heavy vehicles and lots of little cars as well. So it's a noisy little space to figure that we might do some recording. I wish there had been more aircraft noise, but anyhow.
Anyway, oh, well, what can you do? There is a curfew at this airport, not like in Melbourne anyway.
Yeah, true.
Well, that's everything we have for you on this week's Australia Desk. Coming to you from Sydney, Australia. Yeah, right near the airport. It's pretty awesome. Yeah. I'm Steve Fisher.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks.
So you really did your first solo in NAJ, huh?
In November Alpha Juliet. I did,
yeah,
indeed.
Okay. Yeah. Well, how'd you find those PT6s?
Yeah, they were awesome, mate. They were awesome. Yeah. Got a twin rating before I could walk.
Okay. Thanks, guys. Yeah, I can't wait to see the A350 report that they put together. That's exciting for those guys. Exciting for all of us. You guys are there, right?
I'm here. I've been talking and just, but I was, of course, on mute.
Okay. I wasn't on mute, but I figured David knew a lot more about A350s than I did.
It's an airliner. It's a tube that carries people from point A to point B.
How long has Boeing been selling those things anyway?
Selling tubes?
No, I'm kidding.
A350s.
Oh, that's great, though. And the interesting thing is China. You know, the growth opportunities for aviation in China are generally forecasted to be enormous. They have, of course, only just the very rudimentary general aviation industry there. And there's lots of opportunities for that. Of course, they have to work on their infrastructure. They don't have the infrastructure of airports that other countries do. But, you know, it's always a tough thing for a company, I think, because you want to get in there. You want to be part of it. But at the same time, you have to recognize that the Chinese, as I think anyone would, aren't interested in just strictly foreigners coming in and owning the entire business. They want to participate with that, and they want to, well, they need the technology that they don't have in order to develop their own industry. So it's always an interesting prospect to look to the Chinese market and decide how you want to apply your aviation company to that opportunity.
Yeah, tough market, I think, for American companies to break into for, you know, some of the reasons that that you've talked about. I visited there about 4 years ago and was just stunned at how much their modern cities look like any modern city here in the United States. I mean, they've come a long ways in 30 years.
Oh, they have, absolutely. I mean, when I started visiting China 10, 15 years ago, something like that, in Beijing, the way I measured the development in Beijing was there was a proportion. Just look out on the streets, how much of the traffic was pulled by horses, how much was on bicycles, and how much was in automobiles. And when I first started traveling there on business, it was mostly bicycles, some horses, mostly pulling coal carts and things, and, yep, and a few automobiles. And of course, now it's just swung entirely to that, but to the automobile side, of course. But another thing that I always was amazed at is watching other business people, and I'm talking about in the aviation industry, kind of arrive in China and expect that, you know, the locals there were going to adjust to a Western culture and a Western business approach, whereas clearly the way you win business in there is to do just the opposite, is modify your own behavior and approach to be consistent with the culture of that country. You know, a lot of people don't get that. They just kind of go over there and assume that what works in the West works in China. It's just not the case.
Nope, but a huge opportunity. Quite a frontier still for aviation there.
Yep, for sure. Okay, next up we have Rob's Aviation Minute. Rob is going to talk about AOPA's plan, their refurbished airplane idea. And that's the subject of his Aviation Minute this week. So we'll let Rob have the mic.
From Chicago, I'm Rob Mark, and this is the Aviation Minute. One obstacle to learning to fly these days is that so many of the GA training airplanes are old, and many definitely look their age. In fact, it wasn't that long ago that I canceled a nighttime demo flight with a prospective student. I'd noticed that some of the old Cessna's interior lights were inoperative, and early Cessna's didn't offer that much cockpit lighting to begin with. Then I found a few bruises on the outside that had been covered up with duct tape, and I just decided it wasn't going to work. A few years earlier, I'd tried to check out an old Piper down in Florida that looked like it hadn't been washed in 20 years. It flew okay, but after spending the money to fly it, I just decided I wasn't going to put my family into it. And I'm not the only instructor or renter that's ever faced this situation either. And that's why I was really excited last week to see a canary yellow, Cessna 152 sitting outside the south door of the AOPA building at AirVenture. The airplane was part of the 152 Reimagined push from the association, designed to encourage more people to not only learn to fly, but to get back into the air at a relatively low cost per hour. Now, the airplane at Oshkosh that I saw had been rebuilt inside and out. New paint, new interior, even those cheapy plastic parts Cessna used to use were all new. The engine had been rebuilt and reset to zero time, and the airplane had new Garmin avionics, including a GPS installed. This practically new Cessna 152 can be had for $99,000, or $89,000 if you want a 150. The AOPA people chose Aviat in Afton, Wyoming to handle refurbishment work. You can even pick the color scheme when you order one. Now, before any of you start coughing at the $99,000 figure, let's not forget that a Cessna 162, the Skycatcher, a much less capable airplane, was selling for $150,000 brand new before Cessna canceled production last year. The price of a new 172, that can easily top $300,000. What I think will make the reimagined 150 and 152 even more tantalizing to someone trying to build time, especially if it's two or three pilots going together, or maybe a flight school after a rugged, inexpensive airplane, is that these reimagined airplanes cost just a tad over $60 an hour to operate. AOPA is even willing to finance 70% of that purchase. Now, of course, you could go out and find your own 150 or 152 for much less than $99,000. You'd need to find a company to strip it all down, of course. Strip it down for the inspections, replace all the interior bits, hang a new motor, add fresh instruments and avionics. Right, so could you do it for less than $99,000? Probably. But I think that's a lot of work, and I think it's something that we can't expect someone brand new to aviation is going to do. Of course, there'll be plenty of experienced pilots out there ready to tell you about all the other airplanes you can find for less money. But if those airplanes were such a great deal, I guess I'd have to ask why more people aren't buying them. And AOPA doesn't make a dime on any of these airplanes. So one last thought. If four wannabe pilots came up with $7,500 each, they could build a whole lot of flight time for not a whole lot of money. Especially in an era when the magic 1,500-hour ATP limit seems unreachable. Me, I like this idea. But if you have a better one, let me know. You'll find all the information about the reimagined 152 at AOPA.org, where I'm assuming you're already a member. For the Aviation Minute, I'm Rob Mark in Chicago. See you next time. And don't forget to pass along your Aviation Minute link to a friend.
Okay, moving on to listener mail. We got a couple of interesting emails concerning this Transparent Airfares Act that we talked about previously. And this is the issue of do airlines or are airlines required to display the full airfare, including taxes and fees, or can they display just the base fare, the part that they control? And there are arguments on both sides of these. First, we heard from Matt. And Matt said, I wanted to write and play the devil's advocate for the Transparent Airfares Act. Being that I currently work for a major airline, my views are most likely biased, but hopefully I can offer some insight. So Matt says, I know from experience that the DOT's rule on advertising full fares has been extremely costly for our airline just in terms of manpower. He says, we have at least one full-time lawyer whose sole purpose is to vet any changes to our fares displayed. She has also stated that previously the DOT has fined an airline when they advertised a fare that was only available on 8% of their flights. And since the guidance is so subjective, quote, don't be deceptive, unquote, there is no way to know when you are approaching the line and when you've already crossed it. Matt says, my opinion on this is much the same as any small government advocate. Let consumers vote with their dollars. Most people don't seem to have any problem choosing between standing behind their principles versus saving $5 on a flight. Using regulation to protect the people who don't bother to read the fine print makes airfares more expensive for those flyers who do bother to do their research. And then he finishes up, what the airlines are asking for in this bill is a bit ridiculous. But if I had to guess, what they want to do is to be able to highlight to their customers how much of their ticket goes straight to the federal government. Given the recent increase in the passenger facility charges, I think taxes on passenger flight is something that anyone who flies should be aware of. And then we also heard from Stephen. Now, Stephen says that he's not generally a person who writes emails. He says, but I enjoy the show, and as a single engine pilot in Alaska with only 200 hours, I find it to be very interesting. He said, in your last broadcast, you talked about the Transparent Fares Act, and your show was the only place I had heard about it. It actually got me motivated to write my congressman. And then he includes the response from his congressman, which we can kind of paraphrase, because this is from Don Young, who's the congressman for Alaska. Now, it turns out Don Young is also a member of the House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure. And he said that, the congressman said that regarding this bill, H.R. 4156, that this act to allow advertisements and solicitations for passenger air transportation to state the base airfare of the transportation, including or excluding government taxes and fees. So the points he makes are that this rule originally implemented back in January of 2012 meant that airlines and travel agents didn't disclose the government-imposed fees and taxes in advertised prices. He says that it is dangerous policy because Congress is partly sheltered from being held accountable for their decisions to continually implement these taxes and fees. Now, again, I'm paraphrasing here. The third point is that this bill, H.R. 4156, would put the airline industry in the same, quote, flexible advertising arena as the rest of the travel industry, like hotel and rental car companies, which are allowed to advertise the base price for their services while legally excluding the various taxes and fees that are also attached to the overall price. Then finally, the congressman says that H.R. 4156 was referred to the House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure. That's the committee that he's on. And that the committee ordered it to be reported for consideration on the House floor. However, he says, given the opposition that has been raised, I do not expect this bill will receive consideration on the floor of the House. I think subsequently it actually did get to the floor of the House. And so it actually moved forward a little bit. I think these two emails give some more kind of perspective to the issue. You know, one being that if you just have to report or display to consumers the full price, including taxes, then they don't see how much of that is actually taxes, which in this case is a healthy percentage of the total, a very large percentage of the total. And then there's the issue of being consistent with other travel industries like hotels, right? When you go to online, reserve a hotel room, you're dealing with just the base fare, excluding all the taxes that are applied, really until you get to the very end. You know, why should airlines be any different?
I got to say that the one part of the argument that that just doesn't hold up, and I'm sure Matt would rethink this if he took a look at it, is where he is defending fine print as a way to put in fees that don't necessarily need to be made public. I mean, who would defend fine print? Do we need more fine print? Do we need more fees that are not, you know, clearly expressed to people? That to me just doesn't make a lot of sense.
I'm a military av geek and a historian. There will always be taxes. There will always be death and taxes, whether you disclose them or not. So it's sort of like a mute story in my universe.
Well, I guess I kind of want to have it all. I think I expressed this to, I forget if I wrote it to Matt or to Stephen, but I want to know both. I want to know what's the price that the airline's charging. You know, what's the portion of the total that I'm going to pay that goes to the airline? And then how much on top of that is the taxes that are going to be added? And I want to know that, too.
you know, is it going to change my purchase decision if I am comparing airfares? Well, you know, I don't think so. But in the end, I want to know the total price. Even in the case with hotels, you know, when you get all the way to the end through all the process of picking the room and the, you know, the rates and all that stuff, you end up in the end knowing the total price, although it is awfully late in the process. I'd like to see that up front. You know, here's the price for the room, and then here's the taxes you pay. Same for an airfare. Here's what the airline is going to charge you to fly on this flight that you're contemplating, and then here are the additional taxes that are going to be applied to it. Is that so hard? I don't know.
I agree. I really hate getting to the end and finding, even though you know there's going to be more, just how much more it is, because it's always more than we optimistically hope it's going to be.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, while the taxes are a significant percentage of the total, it's not going to make me look at a trip and say, you know what, I'm not going to fly. You know, it's not going to change my decision to fly or not. And taxes, as they are applied, I don't think are or favor one airline versus another if they're both flying the same route. I want to know both.
I guess my problem is the way the airlines do it is, and this goes with the whole travel agency, is I want to know both. I just don't want to know that there's going to be $400 worth of taxes and fees on top of my $10 airfare.
Well, sure.
You know, having booked a trip recently to Las Vegas, more on that later, folks, but...
The Philadelphia of the West, right?
It's amazing how many fees, finance charges, et cetera, so on, your $100 hotel room in Las Vegas suddenly becomes $300. And none of that's disclosed up front. Mm. Or more to the point is none of it's disclosed obviously up front. If you eventually go back, you start learning to read the websites and stuff, and you start seeing who has this fee and who has that fee, and... I guess it's buyer beware, and you need to be an educated consumer.
Unfortunately, that's just so much work. It would be just nice if they could make it simple for us so we could see one price up front instead of have to do so much effort to dig it out. So
yeah, make it easy.
I'm with you on that, David. It's just it's not fun to, you know, to get surprised at the end.
All right, let's move on to an email we got from Micah, who, if I remember correctly, actually, the day this episode posts, I think is Micah's birthday. So if I'm right, happy birthday, Micah, from all of us.
Happy birthday.
Yes. Micah sent in a couple of articles. One is from the Press Herald. Maine-based Elite Airways takes flight path to expansion. In this article, it says that Elite Airlines will be taking reservations as a scheduled charter. Now, the scheduled charter, Micah writes, I am wondering what that means, especially in terms of passenger rights. Does it mean that if a flight is canceled or delayed, a passenger may have limited recourse? Secondly, are there other airlines we know that fly in that manner? And scheduled charter, that's kind of an interesting concept that I don't really know exactly what that means.
It was totally new to me until I bumped into someone about 2 months ago. Who is doing exactly that. Was walking into the flight school here in Palo Alto and ran into a CEO of a charter company from the East Coast who had been out visiting venture capitalists looking for more funding. And he went on to tell me that there is a rule that allows chartered airlines, that is Part 135, which means non-scheduled service, to fly between the same city pairs up to 4 times a week and to actually advertise that they fly between those city pairs. And he went on to say that they're also putting these city pairs into Kayak so that when people are searching on the internet for an airline ticket, they could end up finding themselves, if they bought it, with a ticket in a Cirrus SR-22 four-seat aircraft to fly that particular route. Quite amazing, but it is going on, and it seems like it's a good growth opportunity, especially for smaller cities that don't have good airline service.
Yeah, for sure. And that's interesting, too. And, yeah, maybe as a path for an airline to grow from being just a charter to something more than that. Not that there's anything wrong with being a charter, but I mean, airline desires to grow into a scheduled flight mode, You know, maybe this scheduled charter thing is sort of a stepping stone to that. Lets them, you know, begin to go down that path in an easier way. Yeah.
Well, we emailed about that earlier, David. You were talking about an airline that actually started that way.
It was me.
Oh, was
it?
It
wasn't me. It was Rob.
Ah, Rob. Then he was talking.
Where did you get this concept that I do airlines?
I keep getting you and Rob confused. I don't know how I. No, I'm
kidding. I look like Dan? He's about a foot and a half shorter than me. And
there we go. No, it was. I forgot who the email came from. Obviously, it must have been Rob. He said it was Allegiant, started Allegiant, that way.
Yeah.
He said Allegiant started out as a charter company, and now they've got. Last time I looked, they have two hubs: one in Sanford, Florida, which serves many locations on the East Coast, and one out of Las Vegas. But the odd thing is, there's no connection between those hubs, so you can fly their routes in the West or their routes in the East, but not between those two routes.
All right. Well, Micah sent along another link. We'll just mention it and put it in the show notes along with all the other links that we mentioned. This is from Ask the Pilot blog that Patrick Smith writes. Great column in that blog. It's called The Crash Cluster, and it's some thoughts of his on the recent airline crashes. And Micah suggests that our listeners would enjoy taking a look at that, and I think so. So we'll just pass that on, leave it at that. Jeff wrote in, he asked David a question. He said, given your love for the C-30, he was hoping that David would be able to tell him.
C-130.
David.
Exactly.
Did I say C-30?
You did.
There's no C. Is there a C-30?
Well, yes, there is.
What's a C-30, David?
Oh, God. Off the top of my head. It's an airliner.
Okay. I just thought I'd quiz you.
All I can tell you is I was so happy to be able to graduate from the C-130 and finally start flying the C-152.
Nobody calls it a C-152.
Cessna. Cessna 152, that's right.
Just like nobody who knows that aircraft will ever call it anything but a 130.
Mm-hmm. Except when I read the email
wrong. Dropped it.
All right, so let's get. So Jeff says, given your love for the C-130, he says, I thought you might be able to tell me who operates a C-130 I saw flying very low over my local city park in Colorado. And he described it. It was all white with a purple tail, kind of like Thai Airways paint scheme. And he said, first he thought it was a fire bomber, but the tail was, he said, decidedly purple, not red, and it was way lower from. Way lower than the fire bombers I normally see on the way to drop, perhaps only 1,000 feet or so. He said, thanks for your ideas. Keep up the good work. And David, you did solve that mystery for Jeff.
Well, Jeff and I worked on it together. I'll be honest. He did remind me that currently NASA is flying a mission over Denver, Colorado to check air quality. They're flying a P-3 and I forget what other aircraft they have out there. But they also have a support C-130. Well, once we figured out that piece, it was easy. And we'll put a NCAR has a C-130 and it's quite beautiful. It has a large blue tail with a very large snowflake on it. And we'll put pictures in the show notes. So it's supporting the P-3. The P-3 is flying around air sampling Denver, Colorado, and the C-130, I believe, is acting as a telemetry and as well as doing some sampling. So it's a climate study aircraft. So that's why Jeff's seeing very large four-engine aircraft that I used to see at the altitudes he's seeing. But it's basically because all summer long, NASA is going to be doing air sampling over why Denver's so polluted.
And what's NCAR again?
The Research Aviation Facility, which is the RAF, and the NCAR Atmospheric Technology Division. NCR, I don't know.
All right. That's okay.
National Cash Register something, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I couldn't find
car.
It.
So, but yeah, we'll put a picture of the show notes. It's a very, very pretty aircraft.
It is. I love that paint scheme. Yeah, it's very nice.
It was nice.
Yeah, very good. And then,
but then again, you could put a C-130 in any colors and I'd be happy.
Well, you'd be happy, but yeah, this one made me especially happy. Zena writes in, hello there, airplane geeks. And this is similar. Today, I was taking a walk in the park. This was in Summit Park in Ohio. Zena said, there used to be a small Blue Ash airport 7 or 8 years ago. Now they're developing a park. They heard an airplane flying, looked up in the sky, and it was a smaller airplane. The very tips of the wings were curved up at 90-degree angle, and everything else looked familiar, but the one thing that did not make sense, it was flying backwards. Like, the tail was going forward and the wings were following the tail. So it says, made a circle above us, thought at first it must be something wrong with the airplane. Why was it flying backwards? So this could actually be... Well, it could be a couple of different things. You guys have some thoughts on what Zena might have been looking at?
My first gut reaction, and you beat me to it, to your response was, it had to be something with the word easy in it, either very easy or long easy, or it was definitely a Burt Rutan cantered aircraft. What do you think, Max?
Well, for sure it's an experimental aircraft because there are no certified aircraft that I can think of. Well, there was one, but the Beach Starship would hardly be confused with that. And it was only they only built about 60 of them, and then they smashed them all up when they recalled them and brought them all back.
Oh, now there's still three. There's still three of them flying.
Well, yeah,
I know that you and I were at the same Oshkosh where we saw it fly 2 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. But, yeah, for sure it's an experimental aircraft. And somebody has lovingly built that airplane and maintained it and was probably grinning as they flew by that day. They're very fast airplanes, too, for a GA aircraft.
I just love the way they look, you know? I don't know if it's because they look so different or if it's because they tell us, once again, that there's not just one formula that makes an airplane flyable. You know, there's a lot of ways to fly in the air, and you know, the tube and wings that we normally associate with commercial airplanes is not the only way to do it.
And the funny thing is to see these aircraft when they're parked, because many of them are rested on their nose. They retract the nose gear, and they just are parked with the nose on the ground and the pusher engine kind of pointed up in the air. It's very odd.
All right, moving on to Nick. Nick says, in your latest episode, you mentioned the extremely cool MVP Aero Amphibious Sport aircraft. He says, another similar aircraft that is offered at around the same price is the Icon A5. And he says, check it out. No hammock, but still a neat little toy. And their website is iconaircraft.com. I've always liked the Icon. I always thought those were really, really cool-looking little airplanes.
Oh, yeah, and talk about check it out. They started showing that at Oshkosh, I think, 4 years ago. So it's been around quite a while. The best announcement I've seen on it was that they're going to build them here in Northern California. So they've announced the production location. I think the factory opens next year in 2015. And my recollection is it's somewhere near Vallejo, which is up in the North Bay.
It seems like every time we talk about float planes, amphibious planes, all of us seem to... I don't know, have some kind of an attraction for that kind of aircraft. I don't know what it is. Max T, do you sort of have the same kind of reaction?
They are happy airplanes, I can tell you that. And I'll tell you just how far my reaction goes. I actually own a seaplane. So.
You own a seaplane? Do we know that? Is that a secret? Or
no, I own a Lake Buccaneer. And the reason I bought it is that years ago, not that many years ago, every time I talked with someone who got their seaplane training, they said, wow, it was the most fun 5 hours I've ever had flying, and I've never flown one since. And I thought, well, that's kind of silly. If it's the most fun, why wouldn't you continue to fly it? But it turns out it's almost impossible to rent them. There are probably two places in the U.S. where you can rent a seaplane. One is a 172 on floats up in Maine, and I forget where the other one is. You know, there are many of them, different models you can go out and buy. So if you want to fly, you know, seaplanes, you pretty much have to go buy one.
But they're just...
fun.
Well, yeah, but they're...
It's like freedom or something, you know?
My two biggest loves in life is the sea/ocean, because I'm the son of a sailor, and aviation. And and Jamie knows this, seaplanes and float planes and... When I went to Alaska to visit my friend Jeff, and I got to fly in a Beaver float plane, I was in heaven. It's just they take off in whatever direction the wind's blowing. You sort of have to dodge cruise ships. But but then you land, you know, we went for a flight and we went and we landed an hour later to go hiking remotely. And there was nobody else around. We landed in the middle of this lake. It was just us. We got off. We hiked for a couple of hours. And then it magically came back. But and it's a day I'll never forget. Seaplanes are just awesome. And two years ago, when I went to Oshkosh now, I got to the seaplane base for the first time. And I spent basically a day there because it's a completely different world. And I kept kicking myself, why wasn't I there the first three times I was at Oshkosh? You know, it's there's something magical about an airplane on floats.
Yeah, it kind of absorbs you in a way.
Yep. And a day spent on the water doesn't take away from a day in your life. It's a free day. There's no stress. It's all relaxing.
Well, you know, there's also the other end of the spectrum when it comes to aircraft ownership. And we got a link from Gabriella, who works for an aircraft charter company, or I guess is associated with the aircraft charter company Chapman Freeborn. They had an article in there that's called What is the Ultimate Flying Palace? VIP Airliner Comparison. And this article looks at different airliners that are used as private jets. And apparently there are, well, a number of people who are wealthy enough to own a 737 or a 757, even a 747 in a few cases, as their private, well, flying palace. So this article talks about some of those, and it's kind of fun to listen to or read about how the other half, or maybe the other 0.5% lives.
So, these are the 0.01%ers.
The 0.01%ers, yeah. This is some big bucks stuff. So it's kind of fun. So we'll put a link to that, of course, in the show notes as well.
And that's one of those links that when you click on it, we get the money if they actually buy one?
Yeah, we get a commission. It's 0.0001%, but that'll make us rich.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then finally, we heard from Robert E. Coley. He's our friend from Thromby Air. Of course, you know Thromby Air, the lowest of the low. You can check them out at thrombyair.com. And he writes, do you think Thromby Air invented the airport breathing tax? And at that, we'll put a link to the item in that in Thromby Air's website that talks about the airport breathing tax. But he says, no, Thromby Air did not invent it. In fact, that the BBC reported that Venezuela's Caracas International Airport has a $20 clean air tax. This is, it's a little bit of a stretch, but basically it kind of is a clean air tax. They installed a new system and they're just trying to charge for that.
Is there no limit to what people are going to charge for in the airline industry?
I don't talk about fees. I guess it kind of makes sense. This new system, it purifies the air. It does something with ozone and it purifies the air. And they're actually very excited about this system, very proud of what it does, because they say it eliminates bacterial growth, it deodorizes, and it sanitizes the building. So all that sounds great. But in order to pay for it, they have a departure tax, which is 127 bolivars, which is roughly, I guess, 12 pounds or about $20. So, hey, you're paying for clean air down there. But, hey, you know, maybe that's kind of a lot to pay, but clean air is good.
But where does it end? If they put in a new carpet, do they charge you a buck every time you go to the airport?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, a buck for the new carpet, and then the additional price for doing the deodorizing to take the new carpet smell out of the airport.
That's right.
And so on, yeah. And so on, and so on.
Suddenly it becomes blanket fees?
That's right. Yeah.
or charge if you want to come in the door that we actually fixed, because it costs us money to fix it.
That's right. All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. This has been episode 310. You can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com/310. Again, we were disappointed that Amelia Rose Earhart wasn't able to get connected with us as she's traveling. But we'll pass along that the website for her trip is AmeliaEarhartProject.com. So you can go find that, learn more there.
NotGoneMissing.com.
Well, and then do put a link into the TED Talk and as well as what the foundation, because I know she raised something like $100,000 for the scholarships for women for flight training. So she's doing a lot of great stuff.
Very good. We'll put that in there, too. We want to thank our contributors, Steve Vischer and Grant McCarron. Find them at plaincrazydownunder.com. And you can also find Peter Johnson. We didn't have an Across the Pond segment this week, but you can find him at the Aviation Extended podcast at aviation-extended.co.uk, the leading E on Extended. All right, let's tell everybody where they can find us online. David Vanderhoof, we'll start with you.
You can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com. You can find me on Twitter at TM Vanderhoof. And you can always find me on Friday mornings with my co-host Max Flight talking about those UAV things on, I was about to say drone podcast, on the UAV Digest.
Yes, but of course, drone podcast does work, actually. They'll take you to the UAV Digest. Either way works.
I know, and you talked about that the other day, and that's all that's been stuck in my head.
Now I tripped you up. All right, sorry. And Max Trescott, tell folks where they can find you online.
Oh, come join me on Facebook and just search for Max Trescott, T-R-E-S-C-O-T-T, or you can go to my business site at g1000book.com and see the training materials that I sell.
Very good. And I'm Max Flight. Look for me on Google+ and Twitter as Max Flight. Also, as David mentioned, at the UAVDigest.com. Also at the RunwayGirlNetwork.com for the PAXX podcast I co-host with Mary Kirby. You can find that at PAXXpodcast.com, PAXXpodcast.com. Be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter, Facebook, Google+. We're almost everywhere. You can subscribe to us through iTunes. You can find us in your Android podcatch app if you like. We're also on Stitcher.com and TuneIn.com, so you can find us, stream us, download us in a variety of ways. If you'd like to send us an email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and we have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. Benay Wilson, the aviation queen, will tell you about that.
The Airplane Geeks want to hear from you, so please give them a call at 361-GEEKS-01.
Thank you, Benay.
We should get a report. Wonder how Benay's doing on her flight training.
I know. Yeah, we should get a report from her. Maybe we'll, Benay, send us an update. I think Rob wanted us to mention the survey, too.
Well, folks, we really want to hear from you. And we've taken a time and I'll give credit where credit where credit is due. Rob has led the charge on this for a survey. If you go to the, what link, Max?
If you go to airplanegeeks.com/survey2014, that'll take you to the survey.
And it takes about 5 or 6 minutes, 10 minutes at the most, if you have a slow internet connection. And you can do it on your phone. And basically, we just want to hear from you, get some facts and figures, what history segment you like the best, as the best segment out of the show.
Now, David, why are you using that one as an example?
Well, that's a great example.
Of course. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. I just, but yeah, it's going to be a lot of useful information. We want to grow, expand, shrink. We don't know, but we want to hear from you, and we would appreciate lots of you taking the time. And best of all, if you do take the survey and complete it, we are going to give away Airplane Geeks t-shirts.
An incentive.
I guess we're going to keep it up for about a month, Max.
Yeah, and on the t-shirts, I think we're going to randomly select a couple of folks. So the survey can be anonymous, but you don't go into the drawing for a t-shirt if you do that. So at the end of the survey, there's a place where you can put in your email address if you'd like to be considered for the t-shirt drawing.
Otherwise, we will not be using your email addresses for anything else other than that. So you can feel confident in that. We'd like you to help us create better content for you. So your feedback is really important.
And best of all, it's free. There's no service charge if you take the survey.
That's right. No extra fees.
Damn. Did we drop the ball on that?
Oh, a missed opportunity, right?
Even if you take the survey while you're in an airport or on board an airline, there's still no in-flight fee for taking the survey.
That's right.
No, that's not true. You know, they could be on an aircraft that's charging them for Wi-Fi, so.
Okay, well, your mileage may vary. Everyone's now warned.
All right, with that, opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. And join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Keep the blue side up.
In nearly 5.5 years of producing the Airplane Geeks, Max and David and myself, not to mention Dan and Courtney when they were around, always tried to bring you the best possible content, something that would always keep you coming back every week. We also hoped you'd tell your friends about the show, since word of mouth is the best referral system around. Now, as the summer of 2014 is beginning to wind down, we decided it's time to ask our listeners a few in-depth questions to help us make the show even better. If you'll just take a few minutes of your time after the show tonight and take our brief listener survey, we'll enter your name into a drawing to win one of the 5 official Airplane Geeks t-shirts. The survey should only take about 5 minutes and, well, you'll be performing a great service for the future of the show. This is your chance to give something back, so go visit airplanegeeks.com/survey2014. You'll be glad you did, and we thank you for your support. That survey site again, airplanegeeks.com/survey2014.